A recent report by the News and Observer and Charlotte Observer reveals large disparities in the state's education system. The report shows thousands of low-income students in North Carolina who earn the highest score in their end-of-grade tests are excluded from advanced classes. These low-income students are left out at higher rates than their wealthier classmates with the same test scores. Advanced classes often serve as a track to higher education and can be a pathway out of poverty for some students. Joining me now is Joe Neff. He's an investigative reporter for the News and Observer and co-wrote the new report, Count It Out. Welcome back, Joe.
Good to be here, Frank.
Also, we should point out that we reached out to officials with the Wake County Public School System and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools to join the program. They declined, saying no one was available to join the conversation. Joe, tell me about the scope of this report. What were you looking into?
Well, we came in possession through public records request of a rather significant pool of data of all students in all public schools and charter schools in North Carolina. And we decided, and we could track the students over time. We don't know who they are, but they have these anonymous numbers that allow us to track a child from year to year to year. And there's been a lot of reporting on the achievement gap where the emphasis has been on bringing the bottom, the lowest achieving kids up and getting them to a standard. And we decided to look at the students who are scoring higher, who early on show that they have a lot of potential. How is there any disparity there? And what we found was that the first time the kids show up in the data is at the end of third grade. They take an end of grade math test and a reading test. And we found a disparity for the kids who are scoring above grade level. They're doing well. They're superior. As far as getting into classes for gifted students, there's a significant disparity between those students who are labeled lower income, they're on free or reduced lunch, and the students who aren't. In some districts like Wake County, if you scored above grade level, you were twice as likely to get into these gifted classes if you are not a lower income student. To be fair, the end of grade scores aren't the only, and sometimes they're not even a metric used in assigning students to these classes. But it's clear that you have a step up if you're not poor in getting into these classes, which, as you point out, are key for, you know, getting on the honors track, on the college track.
And what about, and you looked at the figures statewide, right?
Yes.
So you know, give us some of the details, maybe some of the headlines that come out of this, some of the big figures that grabbed your attention.
Well, for example, if you we focused a lot on math because math is sequential, it's cumulative. You can't take calculus before algebra. You've got to keep moving on. And it's more objective and there's less language bias, et cetera. If you scored high on your end of grade score and you were one out of three lower income students went on to be labeled gifted. If you were of more affluent, it was one out of two. If you scored above grade level in fifth grade, at the end of elementary school, as you're going off into the next year into middle school, one of the key tracks for math is, are you going to start high school math in middle school? And for these high-scoring students who get a superior above grade level in fifth grade, if you were free and reduced lunch, one out of two students ended up taking that class. If you were not, if you're more middle class, it's three out of four.
So significant differences. And in terms of outcomes, I thought what was also significant in your report, it showed what happened if poor, lower income students do make it into those better classes. They do way better than even wealthier students who aren't in those higher level programs.
The wealthier students who aren't in the...
What it means not to be tracked and not to be put into the program that you were...
Right. One of the things we're able to look at is how students do on a very important college admission test, the ACT. North Carolina now administers it to all students in high school. And students, poor people who are put into the eighth grade math class, they scored much higher, 3 to 5 points higher on the ACT test. And 3 points or 5 points on an ACT test, people pay a lot of money for coaching for that. The maximum score is 36. So it's a big deal.
So they get higher than for students, wealthier students who didn't get placed in the advanced math. So it's really important that you get properly placed. And your figures suggest that that's not happening across the state of North Carolina. We're going to talk more about it. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter with the News and Observer. We're talking about a report in the NNO and the Charlotte Observer about disparities in the education system. We'll talk about that some more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're still talking about a recent report in the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer about disparities in education. This report reveals that thousands of high-achieving, low-income students in North Carolina are left out of advanced classes. And we should note that we reached out to officials with the Wake County Public School System in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. They declined to join us, although I think we will have shortly a representative of the school system on the program. But right now, Joe Neff, let's talk about these school systems. They screen for gifted classes. You talked about the end of grade not being the only marker. So how do they determine who gets into these classes?
Well, generally, they administer national tests that are normed to the entire population. And they go by, there's an aptitude test called the COGAT. There's an achievement test called Iowa Basic Skills. And most school systems use some combination of these, and they have differing cutoffs. Do you score in the top 2%, the top 5%, the top 10%? And so that they'll use those. Other school systems will use the EOG test in conjunction. So it varies district to district. This state law gives every school district the authority and power to set its own policy in the gifted classes.
And what about teacher recommendations? That does play an important part, at least in some districts, right?
Some districts, a teacher recommendation is a parent recommendation. A parent can apply.
All right. And we talked about the importance of the end of grade test, of course, and important in terms of their trajectory. Now, for some families, if you didn't get put in, if you weren't set into on the advanced track, your family can advocate for you, right? But that's a process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Parents can go in and talk to teachers, talk to counselors, talk to the principal and say, my child should be in this class. It happens all the time in every school, every district across the state.
Of course, the obvious problem is for low-income families, it means that people are very busy, sometimes working two jobs, trying to keep everything together, and the time you would have for advocacy is diminished. So you can see how this can become a battle of attrition or diminishing returns. Joining me now is Celine Miller. She is the mother of Christian Bell, a 13-year-old student who grew up in the Wake County public school system, and their story is featured in the NNO series Count It Out. Celine, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us Christian's story, because I understand at the end of third grade, Christian scored above grade level in both math and reading, but was not placed in gifted classes. What was your response to that?
Yes, that's correct. I really didn't know how to challenge that at the time. And I know that Christian had a lot of behavioral issues that caused his the end of grade testing, the result of that was exemplary, but throughout the year he had some challenges with his grades due to his behavior. So the two kind of merged together throughout the year. So I didn't know how to challenge that and how to separate his academic, intellectual potential versus his behavioral issues that he was having at the time.
What did you understand, or how did you understand the importance of his being placed in these other classes at the time?
We as parents, me as his mother, I knew his potential. I knew that Christian could do the work and that he could handle being challenged. I believe that part of his behavioral issues came from not being challenged, kind of being bored. He would say that all the time, that I was bored, or, you know, he would kind of get into different trouble because he wasn't being challenged. You know, school was boring to him. So it was very important just for, you know, for his future to keep him challenged. So
you eventually enrolled Christian in an after-school program in Raleigh at the Daniels Center, right? Tell us how that played a part in this.
Oh, it was pivotal for me, especially. But my first introduction to the Daniels Center was actually at a networking event at a center that I was formerly with, and I talked with Kirby Jones, and he explained the program to me, which I'd never heard of anything like it ever. And so, of course, I was intrigued. He said it was a summer program where they taught academics. The kids would be teaching and going to different farms and different programs and the STEM and, you know, all these things academically to kind of bridge the gap from the end of year and the next year, you know, how they lose that information from year to year. And so finally we enrolled, and Pastor Jones just continued to encourage us about how, you know, he pushes his children to pursue college as an option after high school.
What did it take for you to finally get Christian placed?
So in middle school, I had to sign a waiver in order for him to be placed in the more advanced classes for math.
Oh, with a waiver? Waiving what? What did that ask you to do?
It just waived. I guess I was kind of given the warning that if Christian did not meet the academic requirements for the class, then we know that we're taking a risk by pushing him to that advanced math. It was our choice to do that.
Well, I want to bring a couple more people into the conversation right now. James Ford is a program director with the Public School Forum in North Carolina. It's a nonprofit based in Raleigh that advocates for equal education opportunities. Also a former history teacher at Geringer High School in Charlotte and 2014 North Carolina Teacher of the Year. James, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Janet Johnson's here as well. She's the CEO of EdStar Analytics. It's a Durham-based consulting firm that analyzes and interprets education data. Welcome, Janet.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And also joining our conversation is Nisha Shaw Coltrane, who's the Director of Advanced Learning and Gifted Education with the Department of Public Instruction. She's on the line with us as well. Hello, Nisha. I'm sorry, is that Nia? Nia Shaw Coltrane?
Yes, hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining our program. I'm going to put my first question to James Ford, actually, and talk with you about Christian's story. You know, students maybe from lower income levels who have been testing high and not getting advanced placement. NNO has done a report showing thousands of students are misplaced every year in North Carolina like that. What's your experience with this, and what's going on, do you think?
Well, first and foremost, I think we have to give kudos to NNO and to the Charlotte Observer for illuminating this. This is something that I think most educators had a sneaking suspicion about. Certainly, folks from low-income backgrounds have felt that their students didn't have the same level of opportunity. But this really is quite jarring and illuminating. And unfortunately, I don't think we've made good on sort of our mandate to provide sound basic education to everyone from the now famous Leandro case. We know that in order to do that, we have to give all of our students good teachers, good administrators, and good resources. And unfortunately for low-income students, they haven't been resourced with what they need to excel, particularly our brightest ones. And so the gaping chasm, the breadth and the depth of the opportunity gap as caused by poverty is something that I think we've just underestimated as a system.
And as Joe Neff pointed out, a lot of the attention has been placed at the bottom, at the lower levels of underachieving students who really fall behind. They may not make it from year to year, but this really looks at students who should be placed in advanced placement and aren't. So, Janet Johnson, I want to ask you about some of, you know, kind of what you look at. Can you tell us what's going on? You're looking at the data. You work with school systems to try to remedy some of this. What's happening in these schools?
Well, for one thing, the folks in the schools don't have easy access to easy-to-use data. So, and one thing I want to make clear that I think might be confusing a little bit here, you don't have to be gifted to be in advanced math classes. Anybody can with a decent teacher can learn advanced math. But the when we help people use data, sometimes the fact that the data shows that some kids are probably ready to be successful in advanced courses, the fact that they aren't gifted might become an obstacle.
But again, do you have a sense of why students who are testing well, then as you say, they don't have to meet the threshold of gifted, whatever that might be, yet they're doing well. We're finding thousands of students who are testing well, and for some reason they're not putting in these classes. What are you finding when you go into these school systems?
Well, we evaluate grants or grant-funded programs, so we often are looking at large data sets, and the students who were profiled in the News and Observer stories, they were like either someone advocated or the one in Charlotte, the school counselor, happened to stumble across the data. And what we see is the schools, they don't have a way to like run a report to see who are the kids we're missing. Mm. I mean, they're not necessarily doing this on purpose. They just don't have good access to easy data to easily identify these kids.
But if that's true, Joe Neff, when you take a look at the survey that you did, I mean, how are students somehow, even if they don't have access to all the data, somehow they're making the choice. And we're seeing that students with good end of grade tests are disproportionately left behind if they're poor. So whatever data they're using, somehow it's having this effect. Can you tell what data they are using and sort of how these effects are playing? Why is this happening?
Well, I think usually basing it on the child's the grades that they've had, their behavior in class, and I think that there's a lot of other more intangible things that come into play. I think that James or Janet would be more qualified than I to speak about.
James, let me ask you about that, because those intangibles or subjective measures can take us into the territory of implicit bias. What do you think is happening here?
Yeah, I think that's a large portion of that. Of course, you know, at the public school forum that we sort of analyzed something similar doing a racial equity study and found many of the same sort of disparities, primarily through the lens of race. But there's obviously a lot of overlap there, because students of color, Black, Hispanic, and Native Americans certainly comprise a larger portion of your lower income students. And some of that is implicit bias. It has to do with the fact that, you know, many of the markers are subjective in their analysis, that it's not completely great. And any norm test, for that matter, is naturally going to be culturally, linguistically biased. You're norming it according to a particular population. Oftentimes, we're not thinking about who's not a part of that norming process. And so there are a lot of ways that these sort of disparities show up that aren't necessarily intentional. But when you look at their impact, they're, you know, it's pretty glaring that is leaving behind lots of low-wealth students and students of color in particular.
Neha Shaw Coltrane, who's the Director of Advanced Learning and Gifted Education at the State Department of Public Instruction. Can you tell us what's going on here? What do you make of this report?
Well, I think this report has really continues to highlight an issue that we have, not only in gifted education, but it's pervasive, like James and others have spoken before me, that in fact we still are really working towards effective instruction and ensuring that all students' needs can be met and mitigating the challenges which are students from poverty and others that we in education need to continue to strive to overcome. And with working, and so we've been really intentionally for the last decade working really hard with all school districts in North Carolina to really find ways, effective programming, and improving identification practices to explicitly, intentionally address these issues through policies, practices, and programming across the state. We have many examples of districts who, like our parent shared, how can we get parent input into the process of recognizing students with high potential, and furthermore, helping them develop programming that, because it's not just about placement of these students, but it really is a pre-K all the way through 20 and beyond issue of how are we creating classrooms that really engage these students and all of our students recognizing potential.
Well, those are certainly the questions that we're trying to address. So let's see if we can get some answers to that, because there is data. There are, students are being placed in these programs. So as if you didn't have enough data, nobody would be placed there. So somehow a student gets there and some students aren't getting there. And I wonder, Janet, when you go into schools that are trying to address this, what do you find when you unpack all this? I'm sure there are some surprises. I'm sure that there's some teachers and counselors who are shocked at what they find when they go through.
Yeah, they often are. They're shocked. And I kind of misspoke. They actually do have access to decent data in the EVOS system, which mm-hmm. That's a data analytics system that the state of North Carolina provides to all the schools. And one of the reports that you can run that we help school districts run is a report that will tell you the probability of a student scoring above grade level if they were to take Math 1 in middle school. And we've helped school districts where we'll run the report for them. And we've had principals, you know, it gives you the kids' names and they know those kids. And one of the principals we were working with, she said she thought the report must have been wrong when she saw the names. And then she realized that.
But you've also found that students and counselors and teachers are using some very subjective judgments. And I'd like you to tell us some of the things that you found that really show a kind of deep bias that's built in and perhaps unintentional, but really suggests that there's some issues that have to be dealt with.
Well, in the federal grants that we evaluate, which that's what our company, that's one of the main things that we do, we have been called in at the end of a grant occasionally, and we are to report who was served and pre and post data. And we might find that, say, a program to teach non-readers how to read, and we run the data and we see that 3/4 of the kids in the program were excellent readers before they got put in. And we'll ask, how did you select the kids for this program? And they usually start by saying with the reading data, but then we say, what reading data? And it turns out there's proxies for all this data. And we have heard repeatedly, we look at the mother's pocketbooks, and we can tell the income level from the pocketbook. And from that, we assume that the kids can't read or what bus they ride. And if we know that bus goes to a low-income neighborhood, then those are the kids we put in the reading program.
So, James Ford, you can see how this becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. If we think the poor kids aren't going to do well and we put them in the programs that where they're not going to do well and we don't put them in the advanced programs, sure enough, 12 years later, they weren't doing well. You see, we were right. That purse told me everything I needed to know about that kid's success rate. What do you do about that, James Ford?
Yeah, so there's a Pygmalion effect, right? Sort of a belief gap, as it's referred to. And one thing that we need to pause to really state and acknowledge is that for better or for worse, there's a stigma associated with poverty, that to be low income is oftentimes seen as being somehow deficient, you know, morally defect, not a hard worker, not intellectually capable. And despite sometimes our best efforts, those things creep into our systems. And so in order to course correct for anything else, you know, you have to inspect what you expect. So we have to, one, familiarize our teachers and our counselors, those who kind of pull the lever between, you know, once a student demonstrates an aptitude or ability to qualify for intellectually gifted, they're in that space that determines whether or not they actually get enrolled. So that is who we have to work with, and helping them to familiarize what some of their biases are, understanding what has formed these biases, and then being very intentional about sort of auditing course enrollments. I think one of the points that was made about the data, I think it depends district by district, but most, I think, district personnel would argue they don't have the same level of access to data that was included in this report in terms of being able to pull students individually and look at their socioeconomic status and see the ways in which they have access to educational opportunity. You may be able to look at that at an aggregate level and see, you know, composition of low-income students, et cetera. But knowing exactly how those students are treated throughout the system is something that, whether they do or don't, most feel they just don't have that level of access. So there has to be a systemic approach that works with, you know, the teachers, the counselors, the leaders, but then also building parents up and empowering them to make sure that they feel comfortable in advocating where they in circles where they oftentimes don't have the same social capital as more affluent parents.
And the time. We're going to continue our conversation with Joe Neff, investigative reporter for the News and Observer, Also with me, James Ford and Janet Johnson, James Program Director for the Public School Forum of North Carolina. And Janet is the CEO of EdStar Analytics. And Neha Shaw Coltrane is also with us with the Department of Public Instruction. And our conversation about disparities in North Carolina's public school system will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Joe Neff, an investigative reporter for the News and Observer, who co-wrote a series called Count It Out, investigating disparities in the state's public education system. Also with me, James Ford and Janet Johnson. James is program director for the Public School Forum of North Carolina. Janet is CEO of EdStar Analytics, a Durham-based consulting firm. And I want to thank Celine Miller, who is the mother of Christian Bell, who spoke with us earlier, also featured in Joe Neff's program. Janet, I want to talk with you about solutions. I know, again, you work with school systems who look at this data, mm-hmm. see the disparities, and want to do something about it. What kind of result? How do you bring schools through that process? Can you give us a sample? And then what happens at the other end?
Several of the schools that we have worked with, once they see the data, and to them, it's the data is the kids. You know, they'll see the kids' names. And we've worked with schools where their school improvement plan, we've helped them look at the data as a whole, and they've moved 50 to 100 kids into advanced courses. And that middle school advanced math is key because that opens the gate to so many things in high school. And some of them are hesitant at first because they're like, we know these kids, and I don't picture them as advanced kids. But they go ahead because the data says they are. And they're successful.
What do they say about, because it seems to me that this surprise factor, you know, there's a problem with any systems. We see it in our police departments and in our schools. Nobody wants to think of themselves as racially biased, as racist, as having implicit bias. What happens when they see the data? I mean, you have to confront something in yourself. Is it difficult for these folks to do it?
It's very difficult. In fact, we see different reactions. A lot of times, some people say, oh my gosh, this is what happened to me. And a lot of people say that, and people are like shocked. They don't want to. They're not. They don't think of themselves as racist. I mean, it's sort of the system has just been chugging along, and without being really examined. And if you think of our nation, the culture of our nation, this is just where we are.
Yeah. So let me ask you, James Ford. Janet just said a minute ago, once school systems see this, or a school, like a school, maybe a building, things change, and suddenly you're advancing huge numbers of kids into these programs, which means, again, there aren't one or two maybe minority students suddenly in advanced placement. This has a huge impact on how these programs will succeed and how students might succeed in them, but I may be wrong. James?
Well, so, you know, on the one hand, yes, but ultimately it depends on follow through, right? So it depends on the way that you respond to what you see. You know, if one continues to look at the situation and, you know, be in denial about it, and as you mentioned, I mean, you know, some folks look at it and say, well, you know, I don't perceive this student to be advanced, right? And if you continue down that path of kind of using the eyeball test or basing what is gifted, what is advanced on the ways we've been socialized, and you're going to continue to see those gaps. But if you put, you know, policy prescriptions in place, measures in place to course correct, you know, if you take a multifaceted identification process, if you begin to look for other markers of giftedness that outside of just performance, but you begin to look more also at potential. In some cases, in our report, the racial equity report, we looked at a district in Arizona where they placed a gifted specialist in every district, elementary school district, to train teachers and staff on how to recognize potential. Now, that takes investment, but I guess my larger point is it can potentially make you know, a substantial increase, but it all requires on the way that we respond to things. Things don't happen on their own sort of inertia. It requires us being honest and then taking steps to fix the situation and mitigate the effects of the sort of class and ultimately racial markers that end up popping up.
Neha Shaw Coltrane, who's the Director of Advanced Learning and Gifted Education with the State Department of Public Education, still with us. Tell us, you know, what do you do now? You've seen this report. You say, well, the state has had things in place. Yes, and it's produced those disparities. So clearly things have to change. How would you see things changing? What do you think has to be done now to make sure that this disparity, you know, isn't carried through in the future?
Well, I think we have been making gains, and we need to continue to work to develop those chains. We have school districts already really trying to address the issues that have been shared, for example, of really having specific programming, like James was talking about, to ensure that we have prepared our students early on so that way they are prepared for our advanced coursework in K-3 in particular. So these students aren't left behind later. How can we really cultivate and develop talent as soon as possible so that way it's not a question of placement, but rather that these children have been moving along all along into our advanced coursework. We also have programs that I think are really important of technical assistance and professional development, like the North Carolina AP partnership that we, with help of the General Assembly and the department, we've been working with College Board. We've increased our Black exam takers and Hispanic exam takers in AP in the last 2 years by 23% compared to nationally to 3%, and our Hispanic 20-8. And what that is intentional programming, teacher education, and really focus on the data that we've been talking about to truly ensure that we've developed a systematic approach to policies, programming, and practices. And the other key piece is to really eliminate barriers in our identification and even in our own mindset shifts that James has talked about. But with our identification criteria, we already have school districts looking at, hey, it shouldn't be multiple hoops. If you want to have children show us their best in multiple ways, so that way maybe one way we can see it. It may not be the same for all. You all focused, Joe and his reporting focused on the OG, which really is a grade level measure. And so how we can take that data, and we should be taking that data alongside others to help ensure every student, we've given them an opportunity to show us their best so we can respond to their needs, but also to create the environments that students may not have had before they entered school.
Janet Johnson, I know you want to respond to.
I wanted to say that the problem, we could solve it tomorrow. I mean, we've got what it takes as far as data goes. And the schools that we've worked with schools where the achievement gap between the Black and white students in math was huge, like 50% of the minority kids were at grade level and 98% of the white. And in 1 year, just by using the data, running EVAS. And, you know, EVAS may not be perfect, but it's
a data set, EVAS?
Yeah, that's the data analytics.
Okay, it's a program.
Program, and it's available to every school. But we've seen achievement gaps close in 1 year. And we've seen schools that have tripled the number of kids that they put in advanced courses. But it's such a culture change that's why we can't just do it tomorrow, because we could do it with the data, but it's disruptive. I mean, it changes the culture so much that we need to address that.
Joe Neff, that you did find a disparity too. Guilford County Schools, for instance, was a little bit of an outlier. It doesn't have this problem to the degree that other school systems have.
Guilford has two things that they do. One is that they've had a lower cutoff, and this is from third grade onwards, if you're going to be labeled gifted. They had a lower cutoff that you could score in the 85th percentile and above and be put into these programs. But the key thing that they do is that at these tests, these aptitude and achievement tests, are usually administered during third grade. Then at the end of third grade, when the EOG scores come in, they would look at all the high-scoring kids, and they would automatically reassess them. Should they be – maybe they weren't selected through the aptitude test, but we're going to take a second look at them. And they say that they put a majority of those kids in reassessing and put them into this more advanced track.
I want to thank all of you for being on our program today. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter with the News and Observer. James Ford, Program Director for Public School Forum of North Carolina. Janet Johnson, CEO of EdStar Analytics. And Neha Shaw Coltrane is the Director of Advanced Learning and Gifted Education with the State Department of Public Instruction. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.